So John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water, they knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine, after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him. Philip.
Well, thank you very much, Simon. And can I add my word of welcome to Simon's? It's great to have you here with us, especially if this is your first time. Well, as Simon said, we're starting a new series looking at some really big questions, some of the big questions of life that people ask. And our question for today is this: is God irrelevant? It was a sunny day, and I was walking along in beautiful countryside with my brother. The sun was shining, everything was perfect, and we got onto this conversation as to why his friends don't believe in Jesus, why they are like that. Now, he's a base jumper, and helps to know that, and so he and his friends, they love jumping off mountains and various things with their parachutes. And as far as they are concerned, Christianity is irrelevant. It is boring to them. As far as they are concerned, when you're jumping off the Eiger or whatever it might be, a mountain with your parachute, well, they're enjoying life. They've got life. They've got real life now. That's the way they look at it. And I guess in that context, they think, well, what else do I need? I don't need Jesus. I don't need God. I guess it's the same maybe for some of us. Maybe that's the way we think, or maybe those we know think like that as well. God is irrelevant. And it fits our culture very much, doesn't it? We live in an age of suspicion and self. An age of suspicion. We're suspicious of truth claims. We're suspicious of any claims to know, to really know. Truth, well, that's a way of grabbing power, isn't it? So people say. And so we're suspicious of politicians and bankers and even vicars. We're suspicious of their spin. The big Oscars winner Spotlight maybe confirms some of that. And we're suspicious of Christianity. It's also an age of the self. Because there is one truth, though, that we do value. And it is this: we want to be true to ourselves. We want to be free. We want to be free to define ourselves. We want to be free to be ourselves. As long as, of course, we don't hurt anyone. But we want to be free. As the band Oasis sang, "I'm free to be whatever I choose, and I'll sing the blues if I want." We want to be free to experience all that life has to offer. It explains all those books, 500 places to visit before you die. 500 places to eat, 500 films to watch, all those endless lists that appear on social media or on Facebook. And for many of us, I guess, life is pretty good. And so we think, well, what else do I need? Isn't God irrelevant in that context? I've got everything I need now. I've got real life now. Maybe my brother's friends are right. And it seems the stats back all this up, as we see January statistics for attendance in the Church of England that's dipped below 1 million. And maybe some of you are thinking, well, religion, that just feels like one long boring church service where I just have to sit still in a chair and pretend that I am good, pretend that I am following the rules. Maybe in that context, God is irrelevant. And yet our passage has a very surprising answer, I think. Because actually what I think our passage shows us is that you are missing out on real life if you don't have the real Jesus. Because life with the real Jesus is better than we ever imagined. And our guide, the person who's going to show us this, is John, one of his two or three best mates. And what he's done is write up a biography of his life. But it's not like the Steve Jobs biography where Walter Isaacson just did a few interviews. No, he was there and he saw it all and he heard it all. And he was with him for 3 years. He saw it all firsthand. And the big point of this biography is in chapter 20 and verse 30 of John's Gospel. Don't turn to it, I'll read it out for us. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Do you see what he's saying there? He wants us to have life, real life, through knowing the real Jesus. And we'll take each of those two things in turn. First of all, then, real life. As the story was read out, I don't know whether you noticed, but it's the big day. It's the wedding. The couple get married and all goes to plan. No one flushed their lines. The best man doesn't lose the ring. The sun is shining. Everything is perfect, maybe picture perfect. And then the reception comes. And then it all goes wrong. They run out of wine. There's nothing left to drink. It's very embarrassing. And you can imagine the looks the bride is giving the groom. Maybe she kind of elbows him in the side. This was his job. She did everything else. But he just had this one big job to do. And it's a mess. And there's no time to run down to Majestic or Tesco's to sort it all out. It's a nightmare. And there is Jesus. He is a guest with his disciples. And his mother, verse 3, goes up to him and tells him what's happened. And verse 7, he tells the servants to fill up the jars. They do it. They fill it up with water. That's all. Maybe they think that's a bit weird, but they do it anyway. And they know it's only water, but they do it and they fill them to the brim. And then Jesus says, take them to the MC, and they do it. And he tastes it. Now, he doesn't know where it's come from, so there's no collusion here. And the groom, he doesn't know either. Amazingly, though, it has turned into wine. Now, doesn't that sound like a neat little party trick? Doesn't that sound like the kind of thing that Derren Brown or Dynamo or David Blaine or someone like that could do? Well, I don't think so. I think there are a number of reasons why I don't think this is a neat little party trick. And it is, first of all, the scale of it in terms of the quality. First of all, then, the quality. Verse 10 tells us it's the best wine that there is. Now, usually at weddings, this is the way it works. You serve a bit of the best wine at first, and then you wait until people are well gone, and then you bring out the plonk. That is the way it was supposed to work. But this is your £800 vintage Bordeaux. This is the best wine you've ever had. You can imagine maybe the wine critics going on about it as they swill it round the glass and they smell it and they breathe it in and they say a fine nose, rich velvety notes there. And they taste it and they think subtle on the palate, complex flavours, a vintage wine, the best I've ever had. You can almost smell it. No, this is no magic trick. Then there's not just the quality, there's the quantity as well. Six massive jars, more like vats, filled to the brim. Verse 6, take a look at that. It says that each one holds 20 to 30 gallons. So we're talking 800 bottles of vintage Bordeaux, or 65 cases of the stuff, We'd need to ask some of you to maybe move from over there so we could get them all in, and some of you maybe over here to come and help carry them in. There's more than enough for this wedding. This is a miracle of vast scale. This is amazing. This is not a magic trick. But that's not all. Because the main reason that we know this isn't a magic trick is because of how John describes it. Did you notice? He calls it a sign. Now, as we all know, signs, they point to something. And these readers, these people, they knew their Old Testaments and they knew what it said there. And in Isaiah, God promised a feast beyond all compare of great wine, where God was the one doing the catering. If you'd like to pick up your sheet there, you'll see the passage. I've printed it out for you, and I'm going to read it out for us. What you might like to follow. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove the disgrace of his people from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. It's a feast. It's a feast of aged wine, refined wine, just like the wine that Jesus creates. But also there is rich food that is eaten. Imagine your favourite meal. Imagine that, the taste, the smell. Jamie Oliver, he would give it the thumbs up. Heston Blumenthal, he would be amazed. But actually, as I start to say that, it starts to sound a little bit banal, doesn't it? I mean, after all, maybe this is just a nice to have. Maybe this is the kind of thing I can get in a high quality restaurant here in London. But actually, it's a picture. It's a picture of the future. Because this is an offer that is out of this world, because it is a new world. Look again at that quote. It's a feast where fine wine is eaten, but something else is eaten as well. Death is eaten. Death is swallowed up. It's a feast where the wine flows, but the tears, they never flow. And sometimes we have those moments, don't we, where we realise, where we know, if we're honest, that we don't have real life now. We're supposed to be free, so Oasis sing, to be whoever we choose. But we're gripped by anxiety and fear and dissatisfaction. And then sometimes life can be very cruel, can't it? Sometimes it does bring tears. And most of all, life is very fleeting, isn't it? Some of my brother's friends, the base jumpers I talked about earlier, some of them have died young. And then in the news, David Bowie, Alan Rickman, gone, age 69. The good times, gone. Gone forever. And a few years ago, there was a really sad story that I read in the Metro about a family in Cheshire. And a husband and father had died of cancer, just aged 38. And the family were struggling to cope with the grief of it all. And so to help, they made a life-size cutout of him. And they put it there at the funeral so that they wouldn't forget him. They even took it to a wedding. Maybe you know something like that. Maybe in your family there's a chair that someone used to sit in, their favourite chair. But they're not there anymore. They're not sitting there. They're not there to talk to. There's no more laughter with them. Or maybe we watch on as people we know struggle with illness. And we're helpless. We can't do anything about it. Or maybe it's relationships that are difficult or superficial, or maybe it's the lack of a relationship that we desire. Or maybe it's work, the uncertainties, the difficulties of work. But real life with Jesus, no one dies and no one cries. It's a feast rather than a funeral. It is a wedding rather than a wake. It is a world, a perfect world, with no broken homes and no broken hearts, no broken promises, no broken people, no cuts, no crises, no family rows, no upsets, no heartache, and no mourning. Can you imagine a world like that? It's out of this world because it is a new world, a new heavenly world. Not a world on a cloud, as sometimes heaven is depicted, but a real world, real life that lasts forever. It is the life that we all want. C.S. Lewis famously said this, "Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum, because we cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." Do you see? This is real life. This is the life that we all want. And that could not be more relevant to us. And it is Jesus. It is Jesus, the real Jesus of history, that offers us that real life. So secondly, real life Jesus. Real life Jesus. I said earlier this miracle is a sign. It points to something. But more than that, it points to someone rather than something. You see, the Old Testament, it promised this feast. But that would coincide also with the coming of God's king, God's ruler. If you like, God's ultimate world leader. God himself. And the punchline in verse 11 of our passage makes it really clear. Let me read it out for us. "This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. He thus revealed his glory, and his disciples put their faith in him." This sign, it points to Jesus, and it shows his glory. It shows us who the real Jesus is. It shows that he is the leader, the world leader that we all want, that we need. He alone can offer us this new world. He alone can offer us real life, a life free of death and pain and tears. And so he's not a cosmic spoilsport. He's not just trying to say no and stop it. He's not trying to wreck your life. He wants to offer you life, real life. And also, he is the ultimate bridegroom. Did you notice? He takes charge at this wedding when the bridegroom fails. Marriage is a wonderful picture of what it means to have a relationship with God, to know him, to have the life we want in the relationship that we all want, ultimately. And it's not distant. It's not aloof. Because he's not distant. He's not aloof. There's no power play here at all. He's generous. He's good. And in a culture of suspicion, that means everything. Because he proves here that he can be trusted. And all of that saves us. It saves us from living for ourselves, for self, which ends up pretty miserable in the end. And so this is the real Jesus. But as I say that, there's a problem. Why doesn't he bring this new world about now? Well, we get a clue in verse 4 as he says this, "Dear woman, why do you involve me? My time has not yet come." It's a little bit awkward, it seems. It's one of those moments that's slightly embarrassing where you want to change the topic and talk about the weather or something because someone's just said something quite awkward, it seems. He says, "Dear woman, what does this have to do with me? My time or my hour is not yet come." Well, either way, it feels pretty abrupt, doesn't it? But what does he mean? Well, I think what he means is the hour for miraculous manufacturing of wine ultimately has not yet come. He's saying this hour is in the future. Because as he explains in the rest of John, and I've put the references there on the sheet in case you want to check them up yourself later, he explains that the hour or his time is the hour or time of his death and his resurrection. What he's saying is before we can have this new world, he has to die and rise again. Well, why is that? Why is that necessary? Well, it's because of our moral failure, our sin, if you like. And the consequences of that, death. And what that means is that in and of myself, I am not on the guest list for the ultimate wedding. Now, I've been to lots of weddings, I'm sure you have as well, and there's that moment, isn't there, when the invitation comes through the post, and you open the envelope, and normally it's some beautiful paper that is there, maybe it's embossed or something, or it's got nice ink on it, and you look at it, and you put it on the mantelpiece, and you normally reply and say if you can come or not. Well, the invitation here, though, is something else. It's not like the Wedding Industry Awards for the best stationery. This invitation is something else. Because this invitation is written in Jesus' blood. The invitation to the ultimate wedding is written not with ink, but Jesus' blood. And what that means is that we can be invited. We can be on the guest list after all. And then when he returns, well, then he will bring in this new world. He will raise his people to life. Life that starts now, but continues forever. The life that we all want. Real life. With the real Jesus. And that couldn't be more relevant. I guess that leaves us then with a question. Do we know the real Jesus? Or do we need to get reacquainted with him? Or maybe we've never been introduced. Thanks for listening. Well, maybe that's raised some questions for you as we close now. And here are three ways that you might want to think about following that up. And the first is, if you take this sheet that you received when you came in, which has got the outline, and turn over the back, you'll see a little box at the bottom. If you'd like to do our Christianity Explore course, that will be your first way where you can come and ask any question that you'd like. Secondly, at the back on the way out, there are some copies of John's account of Jesus' life. You might want to take one as a gift from us and have a look and check it out for yourself. And finally, Simon mentioned that we're carrying on in this series, thinking about some of the big questions. You'll see there on the card, next week we're going to look at how can God allow suffering. Well, thanks for coming, and do feel free to stay and chat if you're able to. There's coffee over there, and I can see there are still some sandwiches at the back.